Hello, fellow Kentuckians and other friends, and welcome to a new edition of My Old Kentucky Podcast. My name is Robert Connie, and joining me, as always, is Jasmine Smith. Jasmine, how are you today?
I'm doing well, Robert. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Jasmine, what do we have on the show today?
Today's My Old Kentucky Podcast is a long-form discussion of healthcare in Kentucky. We've invited two really exciting guests today. We have Kara Stewart, who is a health law fellow at the Kentucky Equal Justice Center, and Dustin Fugel, a research and policy associate at the Kentucky Center for Economic Policy. And if you follow healthcare in Kentucky at all, you've probably seen these two in the media spouting their healthcare expertise. They're really smart, and we're really lucky to have them on the show. And I'm really excited about this discussion because all of these people know more than I do about healthcare. So I'm really looking forward to this.
All right, guys. Let's start by talking about the Affordable Care Act. Obviously, it's a huge piece of legislation that touches like a massive portion of the American economy. But for both Dustin and Kara, tell us, what are like the two or three pieces of the law which you think have had the biggest impact on the state of Kentucky since the implementation of the act?
Medicaid expansion.
That's a good one.
Yep. That's number one.
Yeah, I mean, the protections against exclusions for pre-existing conditions would probably be another one. And then, of course, the tax credits are a big deal because you can easily then say to someone, unless they're undocumented, there's something for you, there's something available, but it isn't as big of a deal as the Medicaid expansion.
Right. So I think maybe we should take a step back and talk a little bit about the difference between those things. So like Medicaid is a government program.
It's a federal state partnership.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Where Kentucky's a taker state and the feds pay for it.
Right. The feds pay for it. And well, in Kentucky, we have groups like Passport, or there's several others that are like managed care organizations.
So our Medicaid is almost entirely privately managed. Dustin probably knows the percent, but it's almost all. And we've got five companies that are private companies that manage our Medicaid. So the Medicaid, again, is a state federal partnership, and the federal money flows to the state, and the state distributes it to these five private companies to manage people's care and administer it like private insurance companies.
Right. But the difference is that it's federal money. So it's, it's tax money, essentially, that's used to pay for people's health care who are below a certain level of income, or if they need long-term care or something like that. And that's Medicaid. Well, but then we were talking a little bit about the tax benefits and the pre-existing condition stuff, and that's more on the commercial side, right?
Right, yeah. I mean, they're still – I'm going to grab Dustin back in here for a second. It just depends on your income level as to what amount you're getting and how it's getting subsidized. Mm-hmm. So we subsidize people in the private employer market too. So if you are employed somewhere and your coverage is paid for in part by your employer, that's also subsidized by the federal government because your employer doesn't pay taxes on whatever they're contributing to your health care.
Yeah.
So all of us have subsidized health coverage. It's either through the VA or through your employer, which then they aren't paying taxes on that, or through a private marketplace where you're maybe getting a direct payment directly to your insurer, or through Medicaid or Medicare.
Right.
Yeah, and let's back up again, too. When we're talking about Medicaid expansion, we're talking about something really specific. So
yes.
Medicaid traditionally covers, pregnant women and children and people with disabilities
Not
and seniors.
Men.
But when the ACA was passed, it gave states the option to increase the eligibility threshold. So it's 133% of the federal poverty level. It's about $16,000 for an individual. And that means everybody. So childless adults and everything. So in Kentucky right now, there's about 1.4 million people on Medicaid, and about 470,000 of those are from the expansion, which is purely from the Affordable Care Act. And that means that we get about $3.5 billion from the federal government each year, and then the state has to kick in 5% of the total cost this year up to 10% of the total cost by 2020. So it's when Kara says it's a state-federal partnership, that's kind of what she means. And then the other part of that partnership is that the state gets to decide how to implement Medicaid. So we talked a little bit about managed care organizations, but there's a few other things that the state can do that I think we'll probably get into later.
That's a good point, Dustin. So when you talk about the proportion that the states have to pay relative to the federal government, Medicaid has forever been a state-federal partnership, but the expansion was set up to be a much more generous state and federal expansion. Like the expansion was, I think when you opt into it, it was like 100% for a few years. For 3 years, and then it dropped down. What are we at now? Are we at
5%?
So we're at, and then it'll only max at, you said, 10%.
10%.
Right.
Whereas traditional Medicaid, Kentucky pays 30%.
Right.
Yes.
And another piece that's interesting is that when the law was originally passed, when the ACA was passed, the Medicaid expansion wasn't optional, right?
Oh no.
Yeah. So it was supposed to be
part of the picture.
Yeah, and it was only after the Supreme Court decision that, you know, made it so that the law, it was technically the law of the land, like officially and forever part of the landscape of legislation that was passed. That, but one of the pieces of fallout from that was that the Medicaid expansion became optional, right?
It became right. this strange creature, which created this terrible gap for the people with the lowest right. incomes in so many states, especially the South, Texas and Florida being real standouts. But what I think is something that Robert just pointed out, that this was to incentivize states to up their Medicaid. So long in the ACA negotiations, very near the end, the level was 150% of federal poverty, not 133% with 5% disregard. And then that got kind of chopped back. But there were already lots of states that were already at that level. Mm-hmm. There are states that have much higher Medicaid levels already by their choice at the same original match. So this was the federal government's way to incentivize, an affordable way to bring more people into coverage.
Right.
So it was really for states like Kentucky. And then we embraced it. And mm-hmm. then we had the nation's largest reduction in uninsured.
Right.
Well, that's a good point, Kara. I think there were two states that had eligibility levels much higher than what the federal government required, mm-hmm. which is important to note, because if that enhanced match rate is taken away, I think it's safe to assume that a lot of states are going to end up going back to what they had before, which was, you know, that really restrictive eligibility, mm-hmm. Which is part of the American Health Care Act, which, again, I think we'll probably get to later.
We're yes. already there.
No, not quite. We're not quite there. One of the things I wanted to talk about was, and Kara, you just mentioned this, and I think that everybody probably knows this, but Kentucky was an ACA success story, in part because of the Medicaid expansion and also because of Connect, RIP Connect, which was the marketplace by which people bought private health insurance. But Matt Bevin's office has submitted a Medicaid waiver, which aims to make some pretty massive changes to how the Medicaid expansion works in this state. So can you guys go over for us what exactly the waiver would do and kind of what you think the prospects are for this waiver as it moves through the system?
Dustin, I will describe where that comes from, and then you can get us going. This word waiver is so troubling to me. Also, thank you all for having us on so much. But the word waiver, I find it so troubling because for a lot of people in Kentucky, it's a really exciting, good word, because it's how lots of Kentuckians get their healthcare services for children with special needs, children with autism, children with Down syndrome. You know, this is how they get it. So they think waiver is good.
Right.
But in this case, this is the governor asking the federal government to waive the application of Medicaid law.
So right. I've always wondered why it's called a Medicaid waiver, because it makes it sound like a good thing.
Yeah, it's not. It's not. It could be. This is a distortion. It could be a good thing, because it is Section 1115 of the Social Security Act, which allows states the flexibility to say you don't have to follow the Medicaid law so long as you are doing a demonstration project to use the state as a laboratory, the way states are sort of intended in our setup mm-hmm. of government, to expand your coverage, to increase the services you're offering, to cover new groups, or do something to increase efficiency.
Yeah, and this is also the same thing that Vermont tried to use to implement single payer.
Yes, it
state.
Is.
Yeah.
So, you know, this idea is that you don't have to follow the Medicaid rules so long as you're still promoting the purposes of the Medicaid program. And then what has happened since the ACA has been this real political distortion of this concept of waiving the Medicaid law to create a demonstration project to just try to get the money without doing what it says.
Right.
Right. Didn't Arkansas implement some kind of waiver?
They did. So they expanded their Medicaid program by fully subsidizing private coverage for everyone. And some of the big questions there were, if you've got people with very low incomes paying those copays and trying to figure out the wraparound. I will say, I feel there's data out there, plenty of it, to show that Kentucky's worked better and we've had mm-hmm. better outcomes.
Right.
So I don't think there's any rational debate as to which is sort of a more cost-effective system or better outcomes there.
Yep.
But I think I'm going to turn over to Dustin to describe what the governor's proposal is. I call it the governor's proposal to change Medicaid. And I try to stay away from that.
Get rid of the word waiver.
Yeah. I'm not winning that by anybody, though.
And 1115 waivers have been around for a long time. Kentucky's actually had an 1115 waiver before to do something else. You mentioned Arkansas as one state. I think the state that's most applicable to this conversation is Indiana.
Right.
So like Arkansas, Indiana expanded Medicaid using an 1115 waiver under then Governor Pence, now Vice President Pence. And, you know, they did a lot of things that Governor Bevin liked and implemented with, or I guess copied with our waiver. I guess the most important one would be premiums. So right now under the waiver, if you earn very little money, so under the poverty line, you have to pay a small premium, but a premium nonetheless. I think it's starting at $5 and it goes up to $15. And if you're over the poverty line, it starts at that, but then it raises over time. So the longer you're on Medicaid, the more you have to pay in premiums, up to $37.50 a month, which doesn't sound like a lot. But again, using Indiana as an example, they found that those premiums were a barrier, and that 55% of people who were on Indiana's Medicaid program missed a premium payment at one point or another, which resulted in about, I think it was 13,000 people losing coverage there.
Wow.
For a Medicaid program around half the size, an expanded Medicaid program around half the size of Kentucky's. So, you know, that's pretty significant.
Plus, we have other states. I mean, this is not a new idea.
No.
We've got lots of states, and we can show that there are negative outcomes by adding in a premium cost.
Right.
Now, what's really unique to Kentucky's waiver request is this idea of work requirements. So work requirements have never been a part of Medicaid before. And I was going to say, Kara mentioned that, you know, an 1115 waiver is a request to waive the law in the way that states implement Medicaid. That's only with certain barriers. So there's some things that you're not supposed to be able to do. And under the last federal administration, the Department for Health and Human Services was saying, no, These community engagement requirements are just another name for work requirements, and we've never approved those. We're not allowed to approve them. But under the current administration, Secretary Price and Seema Verma, who's the CMS administrator, the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services, they sent a letter saying, no, please submit these. We would love to approve them. We really want to make sure that we get as many work requirements into state Medicaid programs as we can.
Right.
That's paraphrasing.
I mean, I just want to throw in there, I still think that's unlawful. So until somebody gets around to changing the Medicaid law, I don't see that in there anywhere.
Right. So Basically what you're saying, Dustin, is that when Governor Bevin originally submitted this Medicaid waiver, that it was under the Obama administration, and Obama administration officials had in the past already denied several states that had included Medicaid or work requirements for Medicaid. And now that all of those people are out of the federal government, and now President Trump is there and his Health and Human Services Department and CMS are in place, the work requirements stand a much greater chance of passing. And I believe, actually, I didn't put any of this in our notes, but work requirements as a part of Medicaid were included in the president's budget, this that just came out recently, or...
Today.
Yes. Is that correct?
So HHS came out with their own part of the budget that kind of detailed what was in the larger budget. And in that, they said they wanted to implement certain Medicaid reforms, which would include work requirements for states that wanted to adopt them. Oh, and by the way, I should mention that Seema Verma, who, as I mentioned, is the head of CMS, was hired to help write our 1115 waiver.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. Her company is still around.
Yeah.
Yep. Now, she recused herself from our waiver in particular, but that doesn't mean that, you know, her subordinates wouldn't be somewhat favorable to that.
Sure. It seemed unlikely to pass, and now it seems much more likely to go through. And if it goes through, will it face a court challenge likely? Or do you think that, I mean, what's likely to happen if the Medicaid waiver does go through? Are people going to lose their coverage, or what would it look like?
Well, I'll talk about coverage, and then I'll let Kara talk about the legal side, since she's a JD and I'm not.
Okay. The lawyers have taken over the show. There's half the show is lawyers now.
Oh, so. That's perfect.
Yes.
So from the waiver document itself, their application, they state that they expect 87,000 fewer people will be covered. Now, they claim that that's because, you know, these work requirements will push people into jobs that earn higher than the threshold, and so they won't be eligible anymore, and they'll be able to get employer insurance and all these wonderful things. But A, the jobs aren't there. We're still about 20,000 jobs short of where we should be after the Great Recession. And the jobs that are out there are not really great jobs. They don't pay really well. They don't offer coverage like that. And B, what we've seen in Indiana is that when you have these premiums, people do indeed lose coverage. And so I think we should expect the same in Kentucky. Now, as far as the legal stuff, I'll let Kara take that one.
I would say, I can say sort of abstractly, what I've already said, which is I think that it is not in line with the Medicaid statute. And I think that because we are, what I would say is Kentucky is from the future, because we have got things happening that a lot of states are looking at, that a lot of people are paying attention to Kentucky and making sure that all of the proper challenges are faced.
All right. Well, we will leave that right
for
there.
Now. For,
yes, absolutely. Okay. Switching gears a little bit. So we talked about Medicaid, but at the beginning of the show, we also talked a little bit about the private market for insurance. What people typically call it is the individual market for health insurance that was put in place by the Affordable Care Act. Or I guess it wasn't put in place, but it was bolstered.
Became available, became real, it became much more affordable.
The individual market was not a shady place where terrifying products were sold. The Affordable Care Act makes these marketplaces available. Kentucky had Connect for a long time, but now, like most places in the country, we are using healthcare.gov. And on these marketplaces, people can go out and purchase individual health insurance for themselves outside of the employer system. In Kentucky, three insurers participated in the insurance exchanges in 2017, and half the counties in Kentucky only had one option. This has been pointed as kind of a weakness in the Affordable Care Act. So talk to us a little bit about what the potential fallout is if Anthem or another one of the major insurers opts out of participating in the exchanges next year.
I wish you were sitting here, Dustin, so I could tell if you were starting to talk.
You're the connector. I'll let you take
it. So here, that word is also dead along with connect, which I want to clarify. If you go to connect.ky.gov, it's still there. Okay. It just has lost the functionality for the people above 138%. The only thing that actually we need to say RIP for are the Connect characters. Mm. So the only thing that has actually seen the end of its days are the characters.
The little guys?
Or? Yes.
Oh, wow.
That's the only thing that's actually gone. So that's the only thing with the RIP.
As an application assister, you also don't have access to the dashboard, right?
Oh, no. The functionality is radically reduced. This is an awkward spot for me and a lot of my colleagues in other states, because I kind of want to rail about how terrible healthcare.gov is often and how I have no ability to actually help people, but they don't
custom built website that was designed for you and was really easy to access, and you had a state call center and everything. It's not the same.
I did just go to the Connect website, and it's not as fun as it used to be, for sure.
That's too bad.
Not colorful, no characters.
The characters are gone.
Yeah.
Yes, but it is still there, and you can still access health insurance. So, it's confusing. Dear Lord, we're still a state-based marketplace also. We're just a federally supported state-based marketplace, just to confuse everybody. But back to your question about the number of insurers. It ultimately, and this kind of sounds like a cop-out thing, but it ultimately doesn't matter as long as there's good products, and even if there's one, they could still be tons of plans. Mm-hmm. So there could still be lots of different kinds of plans. And of course, a monopolist would point out and say, oh, but they're probably ripping people off. Well, with the Affordable Care Act, they're ripping off the federal government the premiums are subsidized. And so that the actual cost of the premium doesn't affect the consumer in the same way, which is why the federal government should be using their authority and their regulatory power to encourage more to participate and or punish those that are monopolizing particular regions.
Yeah. The way that I had this explained to me once from a consumer standpoint is that there's a lot of incentive for there to be at least one insurer in the marketplace because you can essentially charge whatever you want and people buy it because it's the federal government paying for it. Whereas the system that they want to go to in the American Healthcare Act, there isn't any incentive for even one to be there. Like if they were going to drop out, they might as well drop out.
Now, I will say one thing about that. There's another protection against monopolies that was built into the Affordable Care Act, which is that they kept something called the medical loss ratio, which more or less means they can only make, the good old MLR. That means they can only make so much profit as a percent of the premiums that they bring in. The rest has to go to medical claims.
Right.
So there's really no incentive for them to just sort of rack up the score, because if they do that too much, then they owe everyone a reimbursement. And in fact, between 2014 and 2015, insurers gave Kentucky consumers $33 million back because they took out too much in premiums.
Right.
And I'll tell you that that's continued, and we have still got some insurers that year after year continue to have to send rebates because they continue to not even be able to make it appear on their accounting that they have spent enough on healthcare.
I also like that they have to send you a letter to tell you how much money you got back. I mean, it comes back on my paycheck, but They actually have to send you a letter to say you got money back. It's not like a mystery how you got it.
Right. So,
I think,
you know,
I got like $2.37 back last year or something like that.
I got like $30, which is pretty nice.
All right.
Oh, nice.
Way to go, Humana. You blew it. You had to give me $37.
Yeah, I mean, Humana's not even the sort of more stark offender in Kentucky as for who is not doing a good job of meeting that MLR.
Right.
So in Kentucky right now, like you said, there's three insurers. One of them, Anthem, is the only one in 120 counties, 59 of whom they're the only insurer. But there's a couple things to consider there. One, those 59 counties only represent about a third of the total population. Mm-hmm. And two, you know, while it would be bad if they were to leave, and there's a few things that could force them off the market, you know, that doesn't mean that people would be left without any options for insurance, because there are still insurance companies that provide policies off of the exchange in those counties. Hmm. So it would mean that they wouldn't be subsidized and they would have to pay a lot more for them, but they would still be available.
Right. Another piece that's a little wrinkle in this is that the federal government and the Trump administration has kind of played chicken a little bit with the cost-sharing subsidies in the marketplaces. I don't know. There's no way to know, I guess, with the Trump administration what's going to happen. But what would happen if the federal government decided not to support the cost-sharing subsidies in the next few years?
Robert, did you follow why the administration moved their position on that?
Yeah, because it would be really bad.
Yeah, it'd be real bad. And the insurers, who tend to have a mountains of money, mm-hmm. sent their mountains of people to the Capitol Hill and said, you've got to be out of your mind.
Yeah.
Wait, did they switch back? Because as of like 2 days ago, he was still saying he wasn't going to pay them.
Yeah, I mean, he's gone back and forth several times. But sort of, after the insurance industry attacked pretty publicly, I thought there's no real way that the Republican Party is going against AHIP and all of the insurers. I mean, who knows, though? Who knows?
It's a dangerous game to play because, first of all, if they stop paying them, insurers could still participate in the market and just increase their premiums, and people wouldn't have to pay more. They would still get the same benefit of the cost-sharing reductions based on how they work. They just reduce out-of-pocket costs. But the federal government would have to end up paying a lot more to cover them. So the federal government doesn't save any money. It creates all kinds of uncertainty with insurers. They have to jack up premiums, which, as we all know, is like, you know, politically toxic for the party in control. And people would freak out because they would see their bills rising, especially people who don't receive a subsidy.
Right.
People, you know, closer to that 400% of poverty level. So it's a lose-lose situation in a lot of cases. And for businesses who deal in risk, like insurance companies do, to inject that kind of uncertainty is toxic. And there are a lot of insurers across the country, like Cigna, Molina, and some of these others, who have said, if you don't pay these, we can't guarantee that we're going to stick around. And right now, in particular, is a dangerous time to be saying that, because their rates are due. And they have to tell the federal government whether or not they plan on participating next year. Iowa, Kentucky, Tennessee, you know, these are a few states with a lot of counties with only one insurer. And that's a dangerous game of chicken to be playing right now.
Right. It would be bad. So I think we can say that.
We can all agree to that point. I mean, a quick clarification: cost sharing reduction, CSRs, go up to 250% of federal poverty, and the tax credits go up to 400%. Both of these are the threats.
Did you get that, Jasmine?
Yeah, got it.
Okay. So the U.S. House of Representatives, they passed a health care reform bill not too long ago.
Wait, the world's greatest healthcare plan of 2017. Please, let's use the formal name.
Okay. Yeah, that passed not too long ago. The process, it was and continues to be full of lots of drama and some outright silliness. It doesn't appear that any of the language in the current bill that was passed by the House of Representatives matters much at all. But what part of the conservative healthcare reform that, you know, is either in the language of the American Healthcare Act or seems to be coming in the Senate version of the bill worries you guys the most?
Medicaid.
That was the answer to the first
Medicaid.
Question.
And, well, it's the biggest part of it. And you know, I also said, I don't know that I agree with you. I think the language in that bill matters a lot.
Me too.
There's not a single Republican senator who has said, I don't want to eliminate the Medicaid expansion. I mean, even Cassidy and Portman and some of these other more moderate guys have not pushed back on that. And there's not a single senator that has said, I don't want to fundamentally restructure the way traditional Medicaid is paid. which is through this idea of a per capita cap, which just means a permanent ongoing cut over time. So that's still in there. The idea of an age-based subsidy is still in there. The idea of state waivers, you know, being able to pull out of what's called community rating and the essential health benefits, you know, that's still on the table. So a lot of what's in that bill that passed out of the House is still very viable in the Senate. And right now there's a work group of 13 men, 13 senators being led by our own Mitch McConnell, you know, hammering out what it's going to look like coming out of the Senate. And this idea that they have to have 52 votes, I don't know that that's right either, because really all they need is 50 votes. The tie-breaking vote would be Mike Pence, the Senate, the president of the Senate as vice president.
Right.
Right. Oh, no, they can lose two votes and then have the tie break come out of Mike Pence. But neither here nor there. I also want to say every word in that House bill matters, and everyone who voted for it, including the 6 out of 8 of our Kentucky delegation, that matters. It is terrible.
It's bad. Yeah. The bill itself is pretty brutal for Medicaid and for a lot of people.
Especially for Kentuckians. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, and then I want to reiterate what Dustin said about the danger of the per capita cap. Per capita cap may not strike you as the death of Medicaid, but let me be clear to you, that is exactly what it is. It is the ending of healthcare for lots of Kentuckians. I mean, if we want to go down and explain that, I'm happy to.
Yeah. So
yeah,
go ahead.
I think we should.
Okay. Well, you never know. I mean, who's listening, if that's the kind of thing they want to know about or not. So what a per capita cap does is it doesn't say like Robert gets $500 and Jasmine gets, you know, $500 and this is how much you get per year. It sort of does that per a class of person. Based on what kind of Medicaid you're in, because you know, Medicaid pays for half of the births in Kentucky. Medicaid pays for the majority of the nursing home care in Kentucky. Nursing home people cost different than your average 22-year-old that is on Medicaid expansion, right? So, but it does send this specific amount of money per person to the state, and it doesn't go up.
And that is very bad for elderly and sicker people, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a different amount per program, which is slightly more complicated than really makes sense to kind of go through. But what does make sense to go through is that it would do the same thing that happened to TANF when mm-hmm. we made that into a block grant. Block grants and per capita caps really just have different names. They're not that different. Mm-hmm. So they're just a way to take away that messaging, because pretty much everybody understands that block grants kill something. And so it's, we're able to
say, they provide flexibility, Kara.
We already have. uh-huh. Have you already heard that we already have a lot of flexibility? Like, so we already have waivers. You can already do stuff. You can already be creative. Yeah, you can already do whatever you want, really, as long as it's not taking healthcare away from everyone, which is the new game in town. Mm-hmm. But the per capita cap is kind of the same thing as a block grant, mm-hmm. just with a slightly yeah. different name.
The idea is that it either doesn't increase over time, or it increases over time much more slowly than medical costs do. And so you end up working with the smaller and smaller pie. And what that does is it requires the state to make one of three choices. They or all three. They
either it's going to be a piece of all three, let's be honest.
Probably. They would either have to reduce enrollment, so they have to choose who doesn't get coverage. They would have to reduce benefits, so they would have to decide what kind of coverage to offer and what kind of coverage to, you know, hold back. Or they would have to reduce payments to providers, which are already 40% of the market rates. And that would force providers to either start pulling out of the program and leaving, you know, Medicaid enrollees with fewer choices, or possibly even go out of business. There's a lot of Kentucky providers that said after Medicaid expansion, you know, that kept them alive. Otherwise, they were headed toward closing their doors. And right. there's a lot of truth to that. The other thing I'll say is that, you know, Rand Paul just a few days ago said that Medicaid is unaffordable. It's unsustainable. And we need to get rid of Medicaid expansion, and we need to make big cuts to Medicaid. And that's what the American Health Care Act does. But on top of the American Health Care Act, just today, the Trump budget includes an additional $610 billion cut to Medicaid.
Yeah.
So those two combined, that's about a 47% cut by 2027.
I want to clarify. Justin, I said it didn't go up. It does go up, but it goes up by the Consumer right. Medical Index. It does not, which is more generous than CPI, the Consumer Price Index, but it's not real. It's nowhere near the real actual increase in cost. So. Yeah.
Right. And either way, you know, with the combined with the Trump cuts that came out today, you're essentially cutting Medicaid spending in half in 10 years. It's pretty, I mean, it would be devastating not only for, you know, the people who receive it, but also for our economy. If you pull about $4 billion out of the economy, which is what would happen if we had a 47% cut tomorrow, you know, think about what that would mean for doctors and nurses and nursing home care and, you know, the economies around those places yeah. where they buy their groceries and cars, and all that kind of stuff.
Well, not just that, but people who work in hospitals on any level. You think about techs, people, phlebotomists, you think Ooh, of like any number
janitors.
Of people. Yeah, janitors, people who do support
security,
staff, all those people. Yeah, and a lot of places. I mean, I think a place like Somerset, Kentucky, where or Ashland, Kentucky, where, you know, the hospitals are the main economic drivers of those places. If you pulled and they've really benefited from this Medicaid expansion because they have so many more people that are paying for their care and they're getting reimbursement and they're being able to reinvest a lot of that money. And if you pulled all of that money out of those systems, that would be pretty bad for the economies of those places. So, you know, that's not something we think about that often, Dustin, and I'm glad you brought it up.
Can we also talk about how the providers and the hospitals... Dustin, you know where I'm going? I'm going to how our provider tax is frozen. So those providers, notice how much we're talking about how much more money they've been making and how there's a payer now for all the people that come in, right? They can now sign them up and get them Medicaid or otherwise insurance and have a payer. Well... they are not paying taxes on any of that. They are paying taxes on their 2006 revenues, which, so in Indiana, their hospital tax is what's paying for their expansion, paying for their 5% share this year and their 10% share down the road. And in other states, hospital associations have offered to do that entirely to cover the state's share because it's such a good return for them. By people having a payer, it's a better deal for taker states.
Mm-hmm.
Our hospital association has not taken that position, but I just want everybody to know that that is on the table and that they are making more money and I want there to be more jobs, but I also would like for them to pay taxes based on their actual annual revenue, not randomly on 2006s in 2017.
Kara's calling you all out.
Two more things on that, and then I'll let us move on if you want to. But the first is, just to reiterate Kara's point, uncompensated care, which is, you know, the care the hospitals provide that they don't get paid for, dropped by $2 billion, which is 67% between 2014 and 2016, which is just enormous. I mean, that's unheard of in, you know, the hospital world. The second thing I'll say is that before the Trump budget, back when we were just talking about the AHCA, the Economic Policy Institute did a little, you know, projection and found that if the Medicaid expansion was eliminated effectively, and if, you know, traditional Medicaid was capped the way they're talking about, Kentucky would lose about 2.2% of its workforce, which is 85,000 jobs, 20,000 of which would come from the 5th District, which is Eastern Kentucky, and that's more than any other of the 435 House districts in the country.
That's Hal Rogers, who voted for it.
What?
Yeah, and that's just to give an idea of how meaningful Medicaid expansion was to Kentucky and how important it's been, not only to the people who get it, but to our economy.
Yep. There's a really interesting Vox Media, the website, they sent somebody to the 5th District of Kentucky to talk to them about the ACA.
Yeah. It's a good one.
Yeah.
And then, so Sarah Cliff interviewed her, and then about 2 weeks later, Sarah Cliff and Ezra Klein interviewed Barack Obama and brought her with them during that interview, and she got to ask him some questions.
Yeah, it was very interesting.
Fascinating.
Yeah. Okay, so just to change gears again a little bit. So, you know, I do want to talk a little bit about conservative complaints about the ACA. And then
complaints about the ACA?
Well, we'll get to your complaints about the ACA next. Is that okay? Yeah, all right, cool. All right, so the first thing that I think a lot of people talk about are premium increases. And there's a lot of questions as to whether or not that's actually connected to the ACA, but we can make that case if we want to. What do you think is the underlying cause of the premium increases that have been seen on the marketplace plans? And is there a good solution to that problem?
The best solution to that problem would be change nothing. The American Academy of Actuaries, the CBO, S&P all said that the 2017 price increase was a one-time correction,
right?
Based on several things. And so if we were to keep everything as it is and not talk about, you know, abandoning the ACA or changing premiums or not paying the CSRs, we would see single-digit increases like we normally do. It wouldn't be these 27 to, you know, 100% increases in some parts of this in the country. Now, as far as why those premiums went up initially, you know, part of that was the fact that these insurers who decided to participate in the market had to do what's called community rating, which just means, you know, they charge everybody in the county the same price based on their age, how many people they're signing up, and whether or not they're a smoker. They weren't allowed to go into, you know, people's homes and draw blood and take their weight and look at their family history, look at their health history, and then give them a custom premium. So to some degree, they were doing a shot in the dark, and there were some financial tools to kind of smooth things out. But those, some of those tools, one in particular called a risk corridor, was taken away in 2015. And so their shot in the dark just took on a whole lot more risk, and they had to increase their premiums to compensate for that. Now, I'm sure there are other reasons, too, that Kara can pick up, but I would say that's the bulk of the reason why we saw this latest round of big price increases that really were supposed to smooth out, given, you know, everything sort of holds steady. But now that we're talking about abandoning, you know, all of these systems that we've set in place and, you know, things that we've been getting used to over the last 3 and 4 years, they're companies that deal in risk. They're going to decide what's best for their bottom line.
I will say I am not an economist. I am not an actuary. I'm not even sure if that's the right word for actuary. But I know people who are. And the ones that I trust the most are at the Kentucky Center for Economic Policy and the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities and Consumers Union. And those fine folks have pointed out lots of different ways that rising unit prices have affected healthcare costs and all of these different kinds of drivers. Like, we know, also, that's something about our economic impact. We have to be honest about the fact that some of that comes from the fact that we're paying too much for healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So it's like this really terrible to talk about twist of really good for us in economic terms and also maybe bad for bigger picture realities that healthcare should not cost that much.
Right. So, I mean, from a unit cost perspective, that would affect premiums for everybody.
Right.
And so everybody's premiums do go up over time. And I mean, if you're employed or not, that is changing. And with the especially the employer market shifting more and more cost to the consumer and to the employee, people are starting to feel a lot of that more and more often. But Dustin is exactly right. I mean, from my read of the situation, which is that if you have a product that you've never sold before, you don't really know what price.
You probably aren't going to nail it the first year.
Yeah, you're not going to get the price exactly right. And so, you know, we saw a pretty substantial premium increase, but you said exactly what I wanted you to say, Dustin, and I really appreciate that.
He's a smart guy.
Yeah, which is that it does seem like it was maybe a one or two time type situation, and once they get it right, they will continue at that same price moving forward.
And we have to focus on trend, not on level of spending, right? Because you're very apples and orangey in just even months, really, because of changes in medical technology, because of changes in chronic disease prevalence, and on the list goes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we don't really have time to talk about this, but it's something really close to my heart.
I'm shocked that
the Affordable Care Act also includes several sections about ways to improve the healthcare system in terms of overall costs, like accountable care organizations, bundled payment type programs, increased funding for chronic disease management, and that kind of stuff.
And a board that was responsible
that still
for
doesn't exist
and out of control price increase, which was never implemented, and is also on the chopping block in the budget.
Yeah, you kind of cut out there, Dustin, but I think that's because Sarah Palin was going through the internet to talk about death panels and shut you off. So. Yeah, that's the iPad board, and they're gone, probably. Yeah.
Well, I mean, no, they never really existed. It existed in the law, but it was never filled. Yeah. There were never actual humans who were doing that job because it became such a political pariah.
Okay. Yeah, so we have gone over time, but I do want to get to this last question, which is to you, Kara. You wanted to talk about your complaints about the Affordable Care Act, but I'm going to frame it in a different way for you, which is to say that what are some ways, if you were in control, and Dustin, you as well,
I like it already.
If you could make the changes, what would you do to improve the healthcare system in Kentucky and in the United States as a whole? Do you think that, you know, some small changes to the ACA are warranted, or big changes, or a whole new system? Like, what do you think would be best for healthcare?
Do I have to live within political reality?
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah. I'm going to have to say yes.
Well, I mean, that's is that not a fair question?
If you don't, I mean, you can just say everybody's healthy forever.
Oh, well, okay. You stole my answer. So living within political realities, I would absolutely, for this moment, I would upgrade the Affordable Care Act, and I would particularly focus on people from around 150 to 200% on up to 500 or 600%. I would increase those subsidies significantly, because when I enrolled people, I saw that's where the sort of shock and crunch came from. And then I would have stable networks. That would be an easy little fix to say, you know, I'm entering into a contract with you for a year, so you're entering into one with me for a year, where the network has to remain stable for that whole time. It means the providers and the drugs you can only add and not take away. Mm-hmm. Right now, you can change every month, and there is some bait and switch that happens. And it depends on which state you live in, if you've got regulators who are really invested in trying to protect against that in any way, or if there are any protections, and then making sure that there are adequate providers in all of those networks. We can keep spiraling, but those are the top three that came to mind.
Those are real wonky, but I'm glad that you got real wonky on us. That was good.
What? No, that wasn't.
Yeah, okay. It was.
I'll push back on that. That was my very mainstream political reality.
So, making sure that there's stable networks and that providers can't go off of, you know, formularies, or like drugs can't go off formularies. I'd say that's pretty in the weeds, but that's good. I appreciate that. Dustin, what about you?
Yeah, I think there's a couple things. I'm surprised Kara didn't mention fixing the family glitch and Medicaid.
The trap. Don't you call it a glitch? Take it back.
Oh, I'm sorry. The family trap. Excuse me. I'm not an application assister. I get confused on these crazy, you know, insurance terms. But, you know, there's a situation that made it hard for families to get subsidized insurance on the exchange. That could be fixed.
Oh, come on. That's got to be fixed.
It's an easy one. That's a really, really light lift. It's not a big deal.
Yeah, go tell us what it is.
Okay, and why I jumped on Dustin, sorry about that. You know, my feeling is that glitches are technical errors that can be fixed by a person down the hall who works in the tech office, and this can be fixed by an act of Congress or
which is a little bit more complicated.
Right, what I think it's not really, yeah, so I think it's exactly. So I want to give it a little bit more weight to understand, but what it means is that we determine, it's an IRS rule that determines affordability based on the cost of employment to the employee alone. So if I'm married and my spouse does not have coverage through their employer or does not work, but I have it through mine, then if my coverage costs me $10 a month, that's going to be considered affordable. And even if it's $1,000 and that's my whole paycheck to add my spouse on, that's still affordable because it's only based on that $10 to me.
Right.
Which is absurd.
It is
absurd.
Just
a complete like fake stupid rule. But that is what the IRS determined, that the regulation for the Affordable Care Act was meant to say, which to me is laughable because it's kind of in conflict with the name. So yeah, that's got to get fixed.
Dustin, you really got Kara going there.
That was, I know, good. Man. I knew that would happen.
That one makes me mad.
I've got two others that I would do beyond what Kara said, which I would second wholeheartedly. The first one is allow a Medicaid buy-in, not Medicare, Medicaid buy-in for folks as sort of a public option. It's a really robust set of benefits that I think a lot of people use and use well. That's what the data has shown us lately. And it's also cheap. I think it's $5,800 per person per year.
That is correct.
Which is a lot less than almost any other type of insurance out there.
Oh, by far. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that would be a really great step forward. The last thing I would say is I would actually keep something that is in the American Healthcare Act, which is what's called a State Stability Innovation Fund. On its face, it's actually a pretty cool idea. It's a big pool of money that states can use for one of eight purposes, and they can essentially make things cheaper for folks both on and off the exchanges. And I think it's a good idea. It's not a new idea. A lot of the purposes for it, like risk pools, but also reinsurance programs, cost, other types of cost sharing reductions, and so forth, they're not terrible ideas. So, you know, I would ditch the rest of the AHCA and just keep that $138 billion.
Yeah, you heard it here first, folks. Dustin Pugel loves the AHCA.
Also, so providers are going to come after him hard right now that he wants everybody to be able to buy into Medicaid.
Yeah,
me too.
It's true. Yeah, that's one of the drawbacks that I see to it is that providers, I mean, it's very cheap because it doesn't reimburse nearly close to the levels of the commercial insurance, and providers are used to those commercial reimbursements and would have to cut down their costs substantially.
Hey,
they need to anyway.
Right.
There's no good reason why the state can't put more money into their part of the share and then increase provider rates. That is totally within our ability as state government.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a very good point. All right, guys. Well, I think that we now know how to fix the healthcare system in Kentucky and the country. And we also have fully diagnosed all the problems in the system as it exists.
That is not true.
No, it's not true. But we did our best given the time that we had. And I want to say a huge, huge thank you to Dustin Pugel of KSEP and to Kara Stewart of the Kentucky Equal Justice Center, for coming onto the show and talking to us. We are both huge fans of your writing and
Mutual Admiration Society over here.
Right back, man. First time, long time.
All right.
Every episode.
Yeah. That's awesome to hear, and I'm really glad that this show is useful to you guys.
I feel like we're gonna have to do a part two of this once we know about our Medicaid waiver.
we wanted to provide
an update on all these things.
Oh, there is so much.
Well, we kind of wanted to do it before that, because I feel like once that actually hits, these people have paying jobs that are very, you know, important, that the Medicaid waiver will keep them busy in their day jobs for a while. So we wanted to get this in before that drop, so that you had a little bit of time. But we would absolutely love to talk to you again once it does hit. So yeah, Jasmine, tell us how people can get a hold of us.
They can find us on Twitter at MyOldKYPod. They can also like our Facebook page. We post our show notes on Medium, and you can find our podcast at any podcast app of your choice.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in, and we will see you next week.